is September 28, 1977. My name is James Murphy, and I'm talking with Major General George Kitching, who served with the, who commanded the Canadian Armored Division during the Normandy campaign. General Kitching, why did General Worthington, the person whom you succeeded with in, as command of 4th Armored Division, why was he removed, or why did he leave the command?
I think the problem was really one of age, because Worthy had, was known as the father of the Canadian Armored Corps, and he really had done more than any one person in the Canadian Army to build up the Canadian Armored elements. In the period in 39-40, when he literally had nothing, he was making people think about the use of armor, as it was known then. He was trying to get people like Fuller, General Fuller, who had written books about the employment of armor. General de Gaulle, or Colonel de Gaulle as he was, and his writings about the use of armor, and of course the German generals, Guderian and others. He was trying to get these implanted into the Canadian officer's mind. And Worthy, from literally starting with 3 or 4 World War I tanks in 1939, when the war started, he got these from the States on loan. I think they took them out of a museum, I'm not sure. And this was the component, the first component of the Canadian Army. And Worthy then, over the next 4 years, really built the Canadian Armored Corps. He was the mind that went into the technical side, particularly. Worthy was a technician. I don't think he ever honestly dreamed of commanding an armored division. Maybe I'm wrong in saying this, but I think he would be always thinking about whether the gun could traverse this, or whether the track could cover that, or what the pounds per square inch of a track would be under certain conditions, much more than he would be thinking about the enemy. I think he, in that respect, is rather like General McNaughton. He was a technician of the highest grade. But because of this expertise, I think the Canadian Armored Corps had been built up. And so Worthy, I think he was then aged, I don't know, but say he was certainly over 50. And of course, don't forget, in those days, I don't know there was anybody in the army over the age of about 40, except General Crerar, that I can recall. Most divisional commanders were in the 30s. Guy Simmons, I think, was 41 or 2. Crerar may have been 50, or a little older, but he was a little bit more removed in that respect. He had served in the First War. Nobody else had. And you get brigade commanders of 28, battalion commanders of 23, 24, 25, 26. And Worthy would have been completely out of place. I don't think he would have fitted, and I think it was generally realized. And so when he returned, he went to Camp Borden, which was the original birthplace of the Armored Corps, and he was delighted, I think, to get back to that initially, because it gave him still the old feel. Nobody had anything against Worthy except that he wasn't young enough to take part in that battle, that's all.
I see. What were, on the, previously we talked about the action that concerned .195.
Yes.
Which involved the BC Regiment and the
Algonquins. Yeah.
What were the other brigades doing in...
The other regiments? Yes.
Or other
yes.
regiments and or brigades during the operation?
Totalize. Well, I think I mentioned earlier that the plan was that our division would strike out from the bridgehead in the first phase of Totalize. We would go out to the west of the Conflans Road, and really going about 10 or 12 miles into through a town called Portigny, 0.195, which was to the west of that highway, a distance of about 9 or 10 miles in phase two. Unfortunately, the bottleneck, the neck through which we had to go, was really much narrower than it appeared on the map. Quite apart from whether we were supposed to take this little village of Gomenil, or whether the 2nd Division was, quite apart from that, the bottleneck through which we had to pass between the highway which was our left boundary, and the right boundary was a quarry, which was varied between 50 and 200 feet deep. Therefore, it was a complete obstacle. You couldn't possibly use it in any sense. So the number of units we could deploy in this initial push-through was very limited. Assuming that Gomenil was captured, and it eventually was by 2nd Division, the next hurdle we had to take on was a bigger little community called Santho, which was attacked by one of our armored regiments with supporting infantry, and taken, captured. Took about an hour, and they were the 12th SS were in there, Kuttmeier's division, and they were very tough gentlemen. They knew how to fight. They were damn good. But eventually it was taken, and whilst it was being captured, another regiment sideslipped to the right. All this within 200 or 300 yards, in other words, within three city blocks, as it were, of an ordinary city. You get on the left a battle going on for the capture of a community, with almost hand-to-hand, tank-to-tank, as it were, fighting going on within the walls of this small Norman village. And then 200 yards away, passing another regiment heading for a quite different battle, and together with its accompanying infantry. And of course the ones who were told to go straight ahead as opposed to taking Santho had the job of heading for 195, which is this point that took so much argument. They, by this time, I would think it would be about 5 in the evening of an August day, with daylight going out around 8 to 8:30. And with a really not too good a twilight in the sense that there was so much dust, so much corruption from shelling and from firing and from movement. Every vehicle that moved, and this was a very dry summer, created a cloud. And so with hundreds of tanks, literally, and hundreds of wheeled vehicles all churning through these communities, going through these very narrow gaps, it was really quite hard to see. So that the other regiments are leaving behind the Canadian Grenadier Guards that headed for Santho and captured it. The next regiment would have the job of heading for Portigny and 0.195. Instead, they got down into Bretteville-la-Rabée, which is about 800 yards short of the Quesnay Wood, which is a very difficult and a heavily defended enemy area. And they fought, it's terribly hard to put certainly onto a tape. You almost want to have 1812 by Tchaikovsky playing in the background to give some impression of the sound, of the volume of sound. Not so much the sound that's close to you, but everywhere there in the distance, if it isn't too close, and you hope it isn't, maybe 100, 300, 500 yards away, or 1,000 yards away, there's a crump, or a crush, or a crank, or a crump, 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 crump. And it's terribly hard to know who the hell's winning the war, and who isn't. In other words, who the hell is somebody firing at ahead, right? So the regiment that bypasses Santho being looked after by another one, it then goes past about another 2 miles, 3 miles, 2 miles down the road, and ends up in this very pretty little Norman string of villages, really almost of houses more than villages, with Bretville La Rabe, Langannery, lovely old names, and with the odd church with a steeple in it, which of course was used by for observation and shot at all the time by the Boche. What were the other regiments doing? Well, this is what they were trying to do, was capture this first line prior to the jump to 195. And unfortunately, of course, they hit the first line at almost last light, about 7. And it took some fighting to get in. And then you wonder what you do. Do you sit all night and let them strengthen their defenses? Or do you try and make some movement that night to keep them really off balance? And we made the decision that the 28th Armored Regiment, the BC Regiment, and the Algonquins could move by the kind of light we could give them, which was searchlights, anti-aircraft artillery firing certain types of shells on certain lines, certain arcs, every minute, a burst of these to give them an indication of north, south, east, west, as it were. We felt that the BC Regiment, and Brigadier Booth was firmly of the opinion it could be done, could in fact attack starting at about 11 o'clock that night and run through the night straight to 195, right through the darkness, accompanied by infantry, and by the Algonquin Regiment. And in fact, they did achieve exactly that, but instead of turning right towards 195, they went left to an area of about 2,000 or 3,000 yards beyond a little village called Estrée-la-Campagne. And so this is what the armored regiments were doing. The problem is armor, really, when you hit an enemy with a firm anti-tank screen or a firm defensive position, armored divisions as such are not the ones to use. You keep them back for the breakthrough, because they're supposed to be capable of achieving their greatest development under that condition of the breakthrough and the breakout. Mm-hmm. They are not to put up against a wall. So as soon as we hit this line, the infantry came forward, the 10th Infantry Brigade. They tried the Quesnay Wood. One of our armored regiments, the Governor General's Foot Guards, did a superb action, and they took a hill which dominated the Quesnay Woods early that morning when the BC Regiment was off in one direction. These people had gone off to the right of our advance and achieved, they went an infantry battalion first. They never fired a shot. They had no support. They didn't want any support. I think you'll find it's in history. The Argyll and Southern Highlanders of 10th Infantry Brigade, they didn't want it to be announced that they were on their way. So they went on a silent attack, as we call them, through the night, and they occupied this hill, and come the dawn, of course, the Boche were absolutely shattered, and gave them hell for about 2 hours, turned all these little Goliaths loose on them. But they were supported by one of the armored regiments, and they held, and they stayed firm. I think 4th Div in that battle did damn well, quite frankly, and Simmons admits it, I think, in his story. Mm-hmm. But they did well because they fought well, but as an armored division, we didn't achieve any tremendous breakthrough. But when you think the Polish armored division, which is on our left, made no yards at all, they went 1,000 yards. We at least went 7 miles. 5 miles, 7 miles. So we got a good credit for that day.
During the, or just prior to the actual operation, the center line was changed about 3 times. How was it, in what direction was it displaced? And
well, the center line, as I think I mentioned when we talked before, is really just, it's your lifeline of a unit, of an armored corps or regiment or whatever it might be. And it's one in which you signpost so that people, when they hit it, know that if they want to go towards the fighting end, they head towards the guns. And if they want to go to the back end to get supplies, they head the opposite direction. So it's always been to me an important road. When you wanted to find a unit, you asked for its center line. And having got the center line, you followed the signs which indicated, whether it was a battalion, regiment, division, brigade, corps, that that was the way, that if you followed it, you would hit the corps headquarters or the battalion headquarters, depending. I don't know why the hell it's changed, except, don't forget, those were very hectic. They were hectic goddamn days. And the 8th of August, when you look back through, when you read the account of the night attack of 51st Highland Division, which was on the other side of the Conflers Road, on the one side was 2nd Canadian Division, with APCs, on the other, under command of Canadian Corps, was the 51st Highland Division. And I knew all the people who had Tom Rennie, who subsequently killed, was commanding the division, and the brigade commanders, I knew two of them very well. When I read through the story of what they went through, no wonder the center line was changed. Christ, they didn't really achieve anything like the success that we had in 2nd Canadian Division. They had had all sorts of blockages and problems, so I'm quite sure that when it was changed, it wasn't done in a bloody-minded way of saying, oh, that bastard Kitching, well, let's change it again, you know, let's screw him up another time. I don't think it was. It was just done that the center line that had been laid down for somebody was not in our hands. This is the problem. So everybody had to sidestep one.
I see, to move over to cover for...
That's right, because you didn't own one line. It was apparently controlled by the enemy or could be shot at by them. In other words, you was no longer a free road. So everybody, in our case, we sidestep one. The next thing we know is we sidestep another one. Obviously, there was another problem. It was always we sidestep right, so the problem must have been on the left. In other words, it was 51 Highland Div who caused the problem. Not that they knew what the hell the repercussions were on us. And don't forget also, as Guy Simmons said, the Polish Armor Division, commanded by General Maciek, that there was a very real problem of language. And although we had Canadian and British officers attached to them, who had both languages, Polish and English, you could never quite be sure, you know, that the fellow you were talking to understood what was wanted. And I think this had a problem because on the 9th of August, after the beginning of Total Eyes, the Polish Armor Division really didn't move at all in the history. You can see it went 1,000 yards all day. And as Guy Simmons said in his summary, part of this must have been language. Initially, we never had the Czech Armor Division, Polish Armor Division with us. And it had been only under command for about 5 days of 2nd Canadian Corps. I think if Guy had known Maciek was going to be with him, you know, when we were in England prior to Normandy, he would have got to know him. Maybe that one could have established a quicker a sense of communication. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
How was the communication carried out?
With the Polish? Well, it was done by liaison officers, but for instance, Brigadier Booth, who was killed, who was very severely, he lost an arm and a leg when he was killed. He was hit. He and his headquarters were hit in the middle of this tremendous smoke screen. They went right instead of going straight ahead, and they ran straight into an anti-tank screen and were destroyed. The headquarters only, you see. Mm-hmm. Now, he's evacuated by jeep, the few people that survived in that headquarters. And they take him along the lateral road, which unfortunately led into the Polish Armored Division. A little village called, I've forgotten, Ruvre or something, I remember. So the next thing I heard was about 6 o'clock, somebody told me there was a Canadian brigadier who was dying in a small farmhouse. It looked like he was dead. This is the first information I had that Woody was even killed. It was about 5 or 6, I guess, and he'd been hit around 2. So we went down towards this village. By this time, I got other news that he'd been hit. But they were trying to evacuate him. But a Canadian brigadier wore gorget patches, little red patches on here, which the Polish Armored Division, or within the Polish Army, didn't signify anything. It meant, I think, a corporal or a... I don't know. It just meant nothing, the little gorget patches. Mm-hmm. And there was this guy dying. The people with him couldn't talk Polish. I think there were one or two Canadian orderlies that had tried to get him out, or drivers. And they put him into this farmhouse and stuck him on a bed. And now, I wasn't there, so I can't... But I was told afterwards they tried to get from the Poles the information where was the nearest regimental aid post, hospital. And of course, there was no communication at all. Not that it would have saved Woody. No, he knew he was dying. He knew that. But afterwards, you know, you just wonder if a Canadian surgeon couldn't have done something. But I think he'd been, hit for an hour, 2 hours. So I would think the loss of blood and everything else would have finished him off. But I do remember he was evacuated. Instead of from the front to the rear, he went from side to side. This is only because of all the smoke and confusion and the fog. And as a result, he ended up in an area of Polish soldiers who didn't know what the hell he was or anything about him. So communication under those conditions is not good.
Was there an interpreting unit that your division would have in order to be able
No,
to
there use? Were about, I think about 10 or 12 liaison officers. There were liaison officers with the artillery. And we had one, I think, at division. And there may have been one at brigade, I'm not sure. But they were few and far between. The silly thing is, I think, that if you'd culled the Canadian Army at the time, about 5% could have spoken Polish, you know. Mm-hmm. But they were all in infantry units scattered along the line, and that was that. But as someone said, subsequently, the liaison with Maciek's division was superb, because we learned through bitter experience. And I think Maciek probably had better communicators, and we did too. I think we realized that we needed more of them.
Earlier we talked about the brigade commanders. In passing, I'd like to ask you now more specifically what was your opinion of the effectiveness of the commanders?
Well, I was lucky. I think I mentioned when we talked last time, the three brigadiers that I had in 4th Armoured were all from Italy, all men that I knew exceptionally well. The armored brigade was Boothi, who had a DSO and an MC, two DSOs, from one in Sicily, one in Italy. A very courageous man, very small in stature. He always said he was so small, nobody could ever hit him. I remember once in Sicily, he came in and he had a big map case under his arm, and a shell had gone right through one piece of the map case without hitting him. And I remember him joking then about being so small and therefore so hard to hit. And he did extremely well in Sicily and Italy. But as I mentioned earlier, I think Boothi had a premonition in Normandy. I don't know why. I just felt this before, long before he was hit, that he didn't expect to stick around too long. I don't know why. I think he knew he was going to be killed, and he just wondered just when the hell it would be. Jefferson had commanded the Edmonton Regiment. He'd been my second in command of the Edmontons when I was with them. And he was a very solid, rather dour Albertan, but a man with good judgment, good courage, and never flapped. He is the sort of fellow that you could live with, you know, if you're going to be on a desert island for somebody with 10 years. Jeff's a hell of a good guy to be with, because you knew quite well that there'd never be a war, but on the other hand, he had opinions and he was strong. And altogether, I think Jeff was a very solid piece of furniture in Fourth Armored Div. He was with it almost throughout the fighting for the whole year. Brigadier Lane commanded the artillery, and Herm was killed in Normandy. He was killed in November. He was blown up on a mine in, I think, the Belgium-Holland border somewhere. Herm was a regular officer, a superb artilleryman. Tremendous fun, lots of drive, lots of energy, and he was again an Albertan, I think from Edmonton originally. So I couldn't have been blessed with three better individuals. But of course, don't forget, they had had no opportunity to train the soldiers under them before. But they went to formed units, formed organizations, and all they could do was talk about what they wanted, what they expected, with their commanders who were under them. There was very little up. They couldn't take soldiers out on training because you weren't allowed to use vehicles or tanks or anything for a period of about 3 months before D-Day. So in that sense, they like me, I guess, they didn't really have a chance to develop any tactical theories or tactical problems on the ground. All they could do was talk theory, you know, to their subordinates. But they were damn good.
What had happened to the previous brigade commanders that had served under General Worthington?
I think Elliot Roger had the infantry brigade. He went to, he went to be Guy Simmons' chief of staff at Corps. And the armored brigade, I've forgotten just who had it for the moment, but may have been Des Smith. But they had gone off to some other jobs. I think what Simmons was determined to do when he returned from Italy was to get into these brigades and into as many units as possible, people who had had some experience in Sicily and Italy.
I see. So it was deliberate that there was no seniority, or there was no continuation of the senior command.
That part was deliberate, yes. Yes. Fortunately, the individuals, I don't think, lost by it. They weren't necessarily great commanders in themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. But I do remember when Monty came and saw 4th Division before D-Day, and I showed him whom I had, and I had several people on the regimental level also that had come back, and I told him who they were. He said, well, I think you're damn lucky, and I think you've got a good team. So we had a lot of confidence when we went over.
Just one last question, if you wouldn't mind.
Not a bit.
You mentioned Montgomery. Well, what was he like with you, say?
You mean with me personally?
Yeah. How?
Well, of course, I'm a Monty fan. Right. You've either got to be a fan or a phobia with him. I think you either like him or dislike him. No, I liked him. I heard him first in about 1942 when he commanded Southeast Army. In Southeastern Command, rather, in Britain, and we were part of it. And I was then at 1st Division. I liked him. When he lectured, when he spoke, he had a message, and he said it very definitely. There was no fooling. He knew what he wanted, and he told you what he wanted, and by God, when he turned up at a unit, that is what he looked for. So in that sense, he was a great trainer, and therefore, to me, as the CO and as a senior staff officer, I thought he was damn good. Now, when we got to Sicily, of course, he was at this time almost world famous. Alamein was behind him. remember when he, when we were getting ready for Normandy, he came down and spent a day with my division, 4th Armored Div, and during that time we drove through the English countryside. And he, Monty, at that then had, as Commander-in-Chief of the land forces for Europe, before D-Day, he had a large black Rolls-Royce, which I remember one of the few cars I've seen, instead of the windshield going forward, sloping forward, it sloped in. It's one of the few cars I've ever seen that were built that way. It sloped in, and as a result, quite frankly, the driver rarely had to use a windshield. I don't know why it was, but it didn't much matter. But I sat with Monty in this car, driving around from different units in the division. So I spent several hours with him, and we were going through some small English village, and of course he was flying the Union Jack up front, which he was very proud to fly with some device in it indicating he was Commander-in-Chief. And of course all the people waved and shouted and so on. And I always remember we were going through some little village, and Monty turned to me and he said, who are they cheering for, you know? And of course all I could say was, I'm sure it's not me, sir. And he said, oh, isn't it? You know, in that sort of querulous way he would have. Now, I thought Monty was a great soldier. He became, I think, very impatient in Normandy because he was under great pressure from Churchill, from Roosevelt, from Eisenhower to try and speed up the
advance.
The breakthrough south of Caen. The Air Force were after him for a bigger area in order to produce airfields. Churchill wanted him to get more ground on our left, that was where we were, in order to give the Americans more of an opportunity, and Roosevelt was after him. Everybody was after him. And I know when I finally left 4th Armored Div, I had my meeting with Simmons, and I went back to the division and said goodbye to one or two people. And then I went back to Army headquarters, Canadian Army headquarters, and I got there late at night, I guess about 9. And the Chief of Staff, General Churchill Mann, Church Mann was there. And I had a drink with him, and Church is an old friend, and he commiserated me with my losing command of the division and so on. And he said, the Army Commander is going to see you in the morning. So about 8:30 the next morning, before Crerar, I went up forward to see what was going on. I had half an hour with him. Now, I always remember, Harry said, Kitching, you're tired. And I said, Christ, I'm tired. I've never been so tired in my life. I hadn't been to bed for about 4 nights in a row. But I said, nobody has. So we're all pooped. I mean, this is not the orderly war of Alamein, that one read about or reads about, that you can go to bed at 9:30 and get up at 6. I said, I didn't have a bed half the time. I didn't have anywhere to sleep. I slept on the bloody ground, anywhere I could find. And if it was raining, you just curl up under something and hope to Christ you don't get too wet. And you sleep for half an hour, and then somebody wakes you up again. So I said, I'm exhausted. And Harry said, all I can tell you is that Simmons is under great pressure, because I put him under great pressure. And he said, I always remember, Crerar said, Kitching, I'm under great pressure myself. In fact, Monty has told me that unless I do something about it, I'm quite likely to lose my job. And, you know, when Harry Crerar has the kindness to say this, it softened the blow a little bit with me. Mm-hmm. And so I took off, and that was that. But he was, Crerar was kindness. That particular day, I think Monty, he'd kept the screws on. He had to, because he himself. And I think this is, to me, is the tragedy of Normandy, quite frankly. That everybody was turning the goddamn screw. And when you think of it now, when you look back and see what Ultra gave them in the way of information, they didn't need to turn a screw. All everybody had to do was sit back and keep bombing for another 3 or 4 nights or do something. You know, you didn't have to be quite so insistent if that's the right word, insistent, no more than that, so demanding, really. If Ultra tells us now, after, and Monty had Ultra, so did Eisenhower, everybody knew what the Germans were doing, everybody knew their strength, how weak they were, you know, in the rear. The more I read, the less I feel that there was a real need, a sense of urgency to hold in Normandy, to fight in Normandy in the way we did. However, that's in retrospect. Do you see what I mean, Jim?
I think I do.
Well, obviously, we had to hold the German. The SS and the Panzer divisions had to be held there. And maybe that was the only way to hold them, was to do what we did. But, you know, when you think Canadian Corps was a damn good corps, and it stuck its neck into one battle after another from about, where are we now, July the 10th, when it was formed as a corps, I think, somewhere around there. And it went from one battle after another up to August the 14th, totalized, then tractable. And we were really just banging all the time up against not huge quantities of enemy, but very determined enemy and damn good, in very, very good positions. There's an interesting thing in the story of Totalize. We are thinking always about the Canadian participation in this, but the 51st Highland Division on the left had exactly the same type of vehicles and the same armored support that the 2nd Canadian Division did in that night attack. And it's interesting. A little village called Tilly-la-Campagne, which honestly was only 8 houses, but it was a little fortress in itself. And it had held, this little community of Tilly, by this time it was rubble, really, which had created a series of forts, because the houses had collapsed around cellars that had been strengthened. And this Tilly, which had been attacked by 2 battalions of 4th Armored Div in successive nights, we got into it, but then we'd been counterattacked by tanks and been pulled out. This little village, Tilly, when 51st Highland Division went past it, and they went past it on each side and penetrated about 3 miles beyond it, Tilly still would not give up. And it didn't give up on this in Totalize. The armor went past it and through it about 11 at night, 10, 11, 12 at night. And at 8 o'clock the next morning, they were still fighting and held up the whole of one brigade, which is supposed, everybody assumed that the Germans would give in, but they just didn't. They weren't built to give in. They were built to fight. And so as the brigade commander said, his name was Jim Castles. He's now a field marshal. Mm-hmm. And Jim said in the story that one of the lessons he learned was, don't think that just because you can make an awful lot of noise on both sides of someone that he's going to give in. You must remember that nobody knows what the hell's happening anyway. So you can make all the noise you want, left and right, but the man in the center will never know what's happening. So always assume he's going to fight. This is one of the lessons. So, Totalize, I think the wonderful thing was we got through the enemy main defense in that area. I think the tragedy was that because of the program, we didn't go right through. In other words, because of all the need for bomb lines and so on, at that time, maybe we didn't need the bombing to the extent we thought we did. Maybe after that night, we should have, instead of saying we wait till 2 in the afternoon before we lift the bomb line, maybe at 7 in the morning, we should have said no bombing for 4 hours. From anywhere in front of us, let's find out where we're, let's charge like hell through the gap. And then when we've found a front, if we are stopped, we'll call a bomb line. You know what I mean?
Right.
But these are in retrospect, and one can, however.
2020,
right? Yes, oh, indeed, yeah.
Well, I think I've exhausted the...
Jim, can I mention one thing that you and I were talking about earlier? That is the question of maps.
Oh, right, yeah. I apologize.
For the record, I showed Jim the maps that we operated with in Normandy, and also showed him the maps that we had been training with in Britain. And the difference is almost as if you went from Earth to Moon, because the maps in Britain, on which we trained in all the training areas and on which all our movement is based and tactical moves were made, is probably one of the best map systems in the world. A great accuracy, every little track is shown, every little wood, every little pond, every little house. And then we moved to, and it was dated, I think the latest date was 1941 on the British maps. We then moved to Normandy, and the maps we were using were dated 1910. And they were really blow-ups by the British Cartography Service of a very old map of Normandy. And I don't know why we were obliged to use these old maps. I have no idea, but I have one here in the room. I think probably it was done. I suppose it's part of a deception. They didn't want to produce good maps of a small area of Europe in case, or France, in case it became too obvious that was where we were going to go. But the maps are not easy to read. And of course, being in those days 35 years old, many of the villages and towns had increased in size and roads had changed. And not having contours as we knew them, and instead a form of hachuring, it is terribly difficult when you first arrive to read the map in the way that we've been able to read them in Britain. I think we were, when we went to Sicily in 1943, we were using blow-ups of old Italian maps, but I think we were better off in Sicily in 43 than we were in Normandy in 44 in maps.
Well, thank you very much for
Jim.
All